in chapter 8, and we covered verses 1 through 4. And this was a place in which Ezekiel was mentioning it's about a year later from when he started, when he talked about chapter 1. So this is in the 6th year of the captivity instead of the 5th year. And one thing we didn't really spend much time looking at, but notice it says in the first verse that he was sitting in his house with the elders of Judah sitting before him. So this vision that we saw that a likeness appeared and grabbed him by the hair and took him in a vision. And so we saw that he's being transported from where he is up in Babylon, at least in this vision, down to Jerusalem. But he's sitting in his body is still in his house in Babylon with these elders of Judah sitting there with him, other people that have been taken away in the captivity. And a number of commentators have suggested that the elders came in to inquire, you know, for God's, they came to inquire of Ezekiel questions, or what is God showing you, what do you have to tell us, and that this vision is partly in response to that. So he goes down to Jerusalem, and he sees this image of jealousy in verse 3, and then he also saw the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision he saw in the plain. So he's pointing back to chapter 1, where we saw that really wild vision there with the wheels and the eyes, and which is some sort of a chariot-like portable throne deal. So he gets down there, and the glory of God there. So then we can pick it up at verse 5, unless anyone had any questions from last time. Or is there a volunteer to read 5 through 10?
5 through 10?
Yeah.
I'll do that. Then he said to me, "Son of man, lift your eyes toward the north." So I lifted my eyes toward the north, and there, north of the altar gate, was this image of jealousy in the entrance. Furthermore, he said to me, "Son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now turn again, you will see greater abominations." So he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, there was a hole in the wall. Then he said to me, "Son of man, dig into the wall." And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. And he said to me, "Go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there." So I went in and saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, all of the idols of the house of Israel, portrayed all around on the walls.
So, God's going to take him through a series of revelations, essentially, of different abominable things that, you know, apostate, terrible things that are going on right in the most holy areas, you know, in the temple itself. And so there's the temple is, you enter it from the east, right, and the western end of it is the Holy of Holies, you know, as you work your way in past the veil and all that. There's an outer court, an inner court, and the Holy of Holies. And so the three gates from the outer to the inner court are on the east, north, and south. So this first one he's looking is at the north, where this image of jealousy is. So from what I can tell, nobody knows really for sure what the image of jealousy is, other than there's the different suggestions people have based on things that took place in the past in the temple. There was Hezekiah, who was a godly king. His son was ungodly, Manasseh. And he set up a carved image of Asherah in the temple. And then after he was hauled away and judged, and then he actually repented and turned to God, when he came back to Jerusalem, he actually removed it from the temple. But then a few kings later, when Josiah, the godly king Josiah, has reign, he has to remove it again. So somehow it found its way back into the temple. So some people suggested that even though Josiah removed it between Josiah's time and this time, it or something similar to it has found its way back in the temple again. So it's an interesting thing just to think about, if that's the case, how, you know, there's this war back and forth between when God turns the hearts of people and they cleanse things, and then they pass away or things change, and then this pagan stuff comes back in again and finds its way back into the temple. So it's a you know, it's just interesting how that is that when these pagan influences are just, they're just not dealt with really in a serious, long-lasting way, they just come right back up again. And
just like a weed, right?
Just like a weed, yeah. You know, you think you got it paved over and you think you're done with it, you know.
There it comes again.
These dark things,
yeah,
that are just a stumbling block for everybody, but, you know, pagan influences are not dormant and just sitting there. There's active.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an active thing that the forces of darkness, you know, want to, and man's flesh as well, just go back into darkness. So anyway, I don't know, has anyone else read anything or seen anything about, more information about this image of jealousy? Jeremiah has a couple different passages that mention, make specific mention of abominations placed in God's house, things that are especially detestable to God. And so it's, you know, real similar to, like we've said, in Matthew 24, where Jesus talks about the abomination of desolation, but it's standing in the, where it ought not to be, right? So there's this whole issue of things being in God's house, which it's supposed to be His house, right? So, you know, I was just thinking about this one verse in Isaiah 42 where it says, "I'm the Lord, that's my name. My glory I will not give to another," and we're pretty familiar with that, but it goes on to say, "nor my praise to carved images." So I'm thinking, you know, it's an image, just like in Revelation 13, it's an image of something. And glory is, the glory that's supposed to go to God is being directed to this image. Praise, glory and praise.
That was my question too, is, obviously, there's a symbolic tie to the image that's in the temple in Revelation, right?
Mm-hmm. You've got similar principles. You've got a place that is supposed to be God's. You have an image that's set up. You have the image being associated with worship and praise, for sure worship. And also the idea that it is considered an abomination, and the result of it is desolation, right? Because you're going to see, I mean, you could call this an abomination of desolation. It's an abominable thing. It leads to the desolation of the sanctuary, not only is it desecrated as far as it's polluted,
mm-hmm.
there's passages where he talks about them having set up things in his house, polluting it. So not only does it pollute it and defile it from God's perspective, because, you know, even for a priest to get in there, he has to go through all these specialized things, everything that all the utensils and vessels and stuff have to be dedicated and everything sanctified, set apart for that special use. So when you have something that's just really unclean and detestable to God, just like, boom, right in the middle of the sanctuary, that's very offensive. And then as a result, he brings judgment, which is ultimately what's behind the desolation. So I think, you know, when you read these passages and you see how something very detestable is set up in God's holy place, that's where you see some of the parallels. And you also get into this issue with Christians today, who, that's one of the reasons why many Christians feel like they have to find a fulfillment for this abomination of desolation in the past. Because for us to say that the abomination of desolation is still future, we're implying by that a future temple will exist,
mm-hmm.
and then also we're implying that future temple has a place in it that God considers significant. And those are both problematic if you have the view that the church is the final temple and there is never ever going to be a physical temple again. And if there were a physical temple, God would consider it an abomination,
mm-hmm.
just the fact that someone's building a temple again after Christ was on the cross. And he most certainly wouldn't pay attention to it or even think there was an area in it that was holy, right? I mean, that's how some Christians, that's a difficulty that you have to deal with. And so when you talk about an abomination of desolation that's future, that has these complications in people's minds, because it's not just a temple, it's a temple that God cares about, or it wouldn't be abominable for something to be set up there. I mean, Jesus calls it the holy place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Staying in the holy place.
So this image, would you say it came from a pagan temple then? Or just from a high place somewhere? Or
it's not clear there. There are some suggestions that these, when we get further, it's going to talk about all the manners of different creeping things and unclean animals that are painted on the walls. And there's the idea that many of these gods are gods of Egypt or Canaan or pagan in origin. Whether this one actually came from a pagan temple, I don't know. You know, the one in Revelation 13, it's constructed. It's newly constructed, right? It's an image that's created, and it's not from another temple.
It's actually an image of the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm. Image of the beast,
yeah.
Right. The first beast. The second beast causes people to make an image to the first beast.
Right, and causes him to speak.
Yeah.
Which could be, it could be any of the, you know, the, what do they call it, these holograms or whatever type things, you know, it could be anything like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation about that. So, the main things to take away from this, I guess, is just this, and Revelation 13, is, you know, aside from God's work in the hearts of man, man's just like a dog returning to his vomit, right? Like it says.
Yeah.
It's depressing, you know, but you just see it all through Scripture that aside from the work of God, man is just turns to these dark things.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of giving glory to God,
I was going to say one thing we could maybe take away from this. You know, we are the temple of God, and when we get things in our heart, you know, that either is competition for God's favor or even replace us, which I don't know if we did that or not, it still remains Christian, but when we do something like that, God feels the same way about us as he does about what happened here, and he's the jealous God, so that's we have to watch out for the new truck or the boat or whatever, you know.
The image of jealousy in your parking, in your garage.
Something that's in
something
your heart.
Waxed on the weekend.
Yeah, something that you'll go out and do that instead of whatever.
Yeah, I mean, idolatry and attention come in a lot of different forms for sure.
You know, you spend your time.
Mm.
No, not in the object.
Mm-hmm.
Or just laziness. I think I'm guilty of that. Laziness spends my time.
You're just contemplating. You're contemplating.
Meditating.
Yes, you're meditating.
So it could be something that seems real innocent, but it isn't to God.
Everything
you know.
In moderation.
Yeah,
so there's also this issue that, you know, I mean, if you don't really know what God thinks is acceptable, then it makes it easier to do things that offend God.
Right?
So, I mean, that's part of the whole issue of one of the reasons he's pretty hard on Israel is, you know, he spent a lot of effort communicating to them what he expected, you know. And he made a big deal about, well, I'm going to pick a place in one of your tribes and where my name will be, and that's where you're to worship. You know, and it was in Judah in this place. And he says in verse 6, see what they're doing to make me go far away from my sanctuary. The sanctuary being the idea of the sanctuary emphasizing a dwelling place. To make him go away from his dwelling place.
So he's already telling him that he's going to go.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to see as we get into chapters, as we go along to chapter 9 and 10 and so on. We'll see his glory, you know, depart. So he has, you know, what you see in this situation is he has a certain amount of patience and tolerance. I mean, a huge amount of patience. If you consider how holy he is, right?
Yeah.
And if you consider what happened to Nadab and Abihu, for example, when they offered strange fire, right? I mean, that whole setting was nothing near like what's going on in this, right?
Yeah. And this didn't just happen over a couple week period, right? It's been going on and on and on. I don't, for
well,
decades.
Right? Yeah.
1500 years since.
Well, yeah.
Abraham.
Yeah. But I mean, even if you look at Josiah, say, as the last godly king, he was the fifth from the last before everything gets sacked. So there's like four more kings after that. Some of them are fairly short in succession, but still, and even before Josiah, it went up and down and up, and it's kind of like a skiing downhill. There was a few little moguls. That was about the extent of it. So it's a long time. And, you know, with the northern kingdom, they had these golden calves, right? And Bethel and Dan, and that was an abomination too, but it wasn't in his house, in his sanctuary, right? So there's a combination. I mean, he hates idolatry everywhere in every form, but this is like sticking your stick in God's eye, you know? I mean, because it's not just an idol, it's not just, you know, somewhere.
Yeah.
It's right in his sanctuary.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's a little bit of a rabbit, but you know, we've talked about this before. One of the things you see here that's that's something I think important to pick up as you study the Bible, is that the relationship of God's glory here in the temple among Israel is a lot different than his glory among the in the church. Because if we understand the New Testament correctly, we can't make him go from his sanctuary.
Right.
We can grieve him.
Local.
We can offend it. But I mean, he won't ever leave or forsake us. We're sealed with his Spirit. So we can have our conscience seared. You know, we can do things to grieve his Spirit. But the New Testament makes a pretty big deal about us being joined to Christ,
yeah,
in a way where the Spirit doesn't come and go. He might fill us or not at times, but he's always within us, even in the midst of abominations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what, you know, Paul, we saw in Corinthians, Paul's pointing back to these ideas about bringing these abominable things into the temple. He's using that,
mm-hmm,
picture to talk about in Corinth, you know, when you're involved with ungodly things, you're joining Christ, if you will, to a harlot.
Yeah.
The same sort of idea.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not threatening them with loss of salvation or whatever. He's just pointing out that from God's point of view, it's offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments or thoughts about this section before we go further?
I just had one. Like,
uh-huh.
If you read back in verses 3 and 4,
mm-hmm,
and he stretched out the hand, or the form of the hand caught by the lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me into the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes the jealousy, was located. And then the next verse, I don't know, it just kind of stands out to me, and it says, "And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw in the plain." And just like the fact that it mentions, you know, right before that, that the Spirit took him to this place where this idol is, and then God standing right there, you know, it's like, it's very, you know, the Lord is being very confrontational in this. And it's a book where I mean, that's pretty clear by now for sure, but you know, it's the fact that he goes to this place where the idol is, and God's standing right there, or sitting right there, we're in his chariot, which,
mm-hmm,
we've kind of established is,
mm-hmm,
is has like, you know, connotations for judgment anyways. It's a chariot, it's a vehicle for God to get around in and
mm-hmm,
and we'd rather him not be in the chariot, right?
Right.
but yeah, and then, you know, he's just being very obviously, like you said, he's showing restraint and being very reserved about it. I mean, as to like what he could be, but it's a very confrontational kind of experience. You know, it ought to make if the other people could see this happening, they would be really uncomfortable.
Mhm. Yeah, and in fact, as we read a little further, they're going to say in verse 12, "The Lord does not see us; the Lord has forsaken the land."
Mm-hmm.
So, like what you're pointing out too, is it's almost like is it Elisha where the armies are up around, and he gets his asked for his servant's eyes to be open to see it, where all this horrible stuff's going on in the temple, and they're just completely ignoring God and feeling like he's not even paying attention anymore to the temple, because,
mm-hmm,
they've gone so far over to paganism, and yet, like you say, God's glory hasn't left yet. So in the midst of all that,
yeah,
stuff, when they think he's not around, he's not seeing, if he ever was here, he's not here anymore. And the fact is, if they could see with spiritual eyes, they'd see that he was
right there, and he's upset. You know?
Yeah, and that comes to what we're going to see, this phrase in verse 17. "Indeed, they put the branch to their nose." There's a lot of different discussion about about that, but there are some people who think that's mistranslated, that it has to do with God's nose. But most of the major translations, I'll take it the way we have it here. But so the reason I mention that is when you look, the word for anger and nose is the same in Hebrew. It's a word that has to do with the flaring of your nostrils.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mention of his nose there, depending on whose nose you think it is. Here it's implying it's their nose, right? And that's what all the more conservative ones take it. But some of the scribes who translated it, since it's a difficult passage, they put notes in the border suggesting that it was God's nose and it had to do with him becoming angry.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just mentioning that because it ties in with what you're mentioning about that he's not happy about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he keeps going on. He uses this phrase, you will see greater abominations. You think this is bad? Wait till you see what's behind curtain number 3. So why do you think he has this whole issue of digging through a wall and then going through a door and then in these I guess we haven't really read that far, but it's when he has to dig through this wall and in through a door, and then he sees these wicked abominations.
Everything's done in secret, maybe.
Yeah, that was my thought too. That it's this whole idea that they think it's hidden,
mm-hmm.
But God, because like he,
where it says that he can't see,
right? He can't see it. Yeah. So not only is this stuff going on, but it's kind of like secret.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes in through this hole in this door, and there were all these. He mentions creeping things.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it mention creeping things?
Well, it takes me right back to the curse.
Mm-hmm.
God's curse is on Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the beast.
Where do you find creeping things? You find it around dead, rotten flesh,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Whatever, that type of
and
thing.
Or just rain in a summer day, summer yeah. Morning will bring creeping things
yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
What's their purpose is to,
as
scavengers in the world, they're the ones that do the little cleanup
yeah.
Crews that go around and clean up all the gunk that's
mm-hmm.
around. And probably what he's saying, he's indicating is that stuff in there is not
yeah.
not even palatable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it is.
So a lot of those animals would fall under the category of unclean animals,
yeah.
Right?
So like in Leviticus mm-hmm. where it talks about certain beasts are allowed and certain ones are unclean, and other than when it comes to like creeping things, other than like locusts, which the prophets ate, virtually all the other insects are considered almost as far as there's some, maybe some exceptions, but the vast majority of them fall into the category that he said, you're not to touch them, you're not to mess with them. And of course, we know it has nothing to do with their inherent quality, and they are associated with. Like Jerry says, a lot of them are associated with things that are unclean, dead animals and dead bodies. They were never to take anything and cook it that died of natural causes or anything like that. And of course, we know too that part of that has medical implications too, that God obviously probably had in mind too. But these creeping things are the equivalent, of going to McDonald's and getting liver and onions or something,
mm-hmm.
I mean, cod liver oil.
That's pretty creepy, liver
yeah.
and onions.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on who you are, but I'm just, I can't come up with
no,
that.
No, it really
analogy.
Is. I hate it.
but it's not just that they're idols, but they're animals that are unclean. They're not just, it's not just animalistic worship, it's unclean animalistic worship, worship of unclean animals that are in the Levitical category that's outlawed, basically.
So whether they're worshiping them or not, they're there, and that's it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
It's reptiles and insects.
Yeah.
Not just.
Yeah, it means, yeah, yeah. I think it's, I'm trying to remember, it's Remish, I think it's the word. I didn't look at it before I came, but mm-hmm. Yeah, it has to do with things that crawl around on quickly on the ground with their multiple feet.
Okay.
Millipedes and some of the
so not a slug.
Amphibians.
I was trying to get slug into,
yeah,
that,
he's
category,
always wanted to, he's got the thing about slugs in the curve.
Slugs would work.
Escargot, man. Just go to France and you'll be happy.
Yeah, you can eat that.
Yeah.
Well, and just like, you know, what you were saying earlier too, just, you know, God made a big deal about how the temple was like a holy place, and like of all places not to have unclean things. This mm-hmm. is the place, right? And then what is it says is that carved on the wall all over.
Decorated with it.
And I think they thought that God had left them, didn't they?
It seems like
God wasn't mm-hmm. there anymore, and mm-hmm. so they were saying that there, anything that good comes to them come from this idol, or an idol that they're worshiping instead of
yeah.
God. So they actually left him. He didn't leave them. But
I get that. But I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, being holy and pure and clean was a big deal in the you know, Israelites' law and their culture, because, you know, God made that a part of their thing. I mean, it's basically like all the commandments revolve around that. You know, being clean, being pure. And just the fact that the most pure and clean place is now full of all this mm-hmm. stuff is kind of significant, you would think, to that. It should have got their attention, you know, before this.
Yeah,
yeah,
and I think this is one of those cases where I mean, I think this is kind of documenting the situation where elsewhere we'll see at the end of Ezekiel where it talks about the Levi going astray.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if the people in the land turn from God, in the temple itself, mm-hmm. the priest should have still been, you know, warding off as much of that as they could. And I think as we get further in this passage, when it talks about some of the people in there, and the implication is that the priests are involved in the worst of it. So like you say, it's, you know, they have this big responsibility, and the fact that the holy area became so defiled and so polluted is something that essentially leads to their permanent secondary status.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds you said something earlier that kind of reminded me of the passage that, you know, Jesus said that about casting out demons, and how it, you know, passes through one of those places, and then it says, "I will return to my house," and it takes along with it seven other demons worse than itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it finds its house swept and put in order. Well, you know, like you said, they took the idols out once or twice, and they keep finding their way back in there, and they keep bringing more with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They didn't fill the house with good things.
Yeah. That's the implication, isn't
yeah.
it, with that passage?
Yeah, and we need to grab every atheist in the United States and bring them in here and get them to understand that they're sweeping the house out, but what's going to be putting in there instead, right? Because they like to think that we can just clean this goofy Christianity out, and then we'll have a nice, clean, empty house.
Yeah.
Uh-uh, it's not going to stay empty.
Yeah.
You can see that already, right? Look at all the cult stuff that's rising up all through our culture.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. I mean...
Yeah.
So, for sure, there's that whole issue that there really isn't such a thing as a stable spiritual condition, really. It seems like, you know, you can kind of take it further and say that, you know, you're either actively moving toward God, you know, and growing, or you're, or things are going the other direction. And that's why there's really no, there's never any, you know, until we get to the eternal state, there's never any true rest. Because like, even if we had like some huge revival in the United States and things were like turned around in huge ways spiritually, and people came to know God in huge numbers, and you know, a lot of things that are unjust in the law and in practices all reversed and stuff, that would be wonderful. I'd be the first person to want to see that happen. But if you read the scriptures, you know that that's not enough. It's the keeping power of God. That's the only thing that holds back the dam of wickedness.
Yeah, you know, and all the times that has happened, it doesn't last overly long. Like, maybe one or two generations at most, and then it just all goes back to where it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in that constant state of entropy here.
Yeah.
I think one thing is, I think in the Old Testament, it tells the children of Israel that they teach their young,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't think that happens. I think, you know, we may get a big revival, and then the kids, you know, start turning sour, and before long, you know, they haven't been taught.
Right.
Things.
Right. Yeah, so there's a failure on all different levels. There's a failure by spiritual leaders. There's a failure by parents and families, you know.
And also our schools are,
mm-hmm.
The communism that's come into our schools.
It's the whole anti-God thing, yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of different mechanics and elements to it. And, you know, I think it's a challenge for us. We talk about it a lot in Sunday school. It comes up here because every once in a while, Greg or I or someone else will bring in some example of something that's going on, you know, in the world, and many of them are things that, you know, are surprising compared to like 10, 20 years ago even. So when you're on that side of the curve for a period of time, it's, you know, it can be daunting, and you almost can forget, you know, that historically there have been some great revivals and great reversals in trends. And there have been countries like South Korea and places in China and stuff where they've had amazing reformations and then counter problems as well. But you know, you never want to lose sight of the fact that the Holy Spirit is able to do anything. You know, his specialty is bringing an oasis out of deadness, you know. And so there's that whole issue. We don't know. We know the general trend the Bible talks about, apostasy, but we don't know really where we are on that and how many moguls there might be where things do change around.
It's like Russia for a season.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're falling.
Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a couple of those type of things where, you know, got open some doors and now they're shut down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure. What should we read further?
Yes.
So somebody want to go from 11 to the end of the chapter?
I can do that if you'd like.
Great.
Okay, and there stood before them 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel. And in the midst stood Jehazaniah, the son of Shaphan, each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Then he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the room of his idols? For they say, The Lord does not see us, the Lord has forsaken the land. And he said to me, Turn again, and you will see greater abominations than they are doing, than they are doing. So he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house, and to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Then he said to me, Have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you will see greater abominations than these. So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord and their faces towards the east, and they were worshiping the sun towards the east. And he said to me, Have you seen this, O son of man? Is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence. Then they have returned to provoke me to anger. Indeed, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore, I also will act in fury. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them.
It goes from bad to worse.
Yeah.
It's happening all over the place.
Mm-hmm. So part of this whole thing too is, you know, in verse 12, where they're doing this stuff in the dark, every man in the room of his idols. And they say, The Lord does not see us, the Lord has forsaken the land. Part of that belief was aided and abetted, that incorrect view was aided and abetted by the false prophets. Because you remember the false prophets with Jeremiah and all that.
Mm-hmm.
God had said ahead of time that he was going to bring Israel into under control and servitude to Babylon, that he had given all these nations and areas into Nebuchadnezzar's, and he was giving them into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, and he gave prophecies of that in advance. And so Jeremiah, among other prophets, was making that known. Of course, he was getting in a lot of trouble because the king and the people didn't believe that was God's, you know, that God would allow that. And so the fact that Nebuchadnezzar came down and took Daniel away and relatively few people, nobles, and then later he came down and he took Ezekiel and one of the kings away, and then they set up a vassal king there. That was completely in alignment with what Jeremiah was predicting. And obviously, if Jeremiah had predicted it and it was really was God's plan, then it wouldn't be correct to assume that God had left, right? Because, I mean, it's going according to his plan. But I think because these guys were listening to the false prophets who kept saying peace, peace, when God wasn't saying there was going to be peace, so they had this expectation that God was going to not allow this to happen and he was going to intervene. And the fact that Nebuchadnezzar had already been down there and taken people away twice already pushed them into this idea that either God's not able or he's left, because it can't be his will. So this is one of those cases again where the human heart has a propensity to rationalize and get rid of God. But also, you know, it doesn't help if you're misreading the times, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like what Jesus talks about with the Pharisees, you know, you can see the red sky and all this, but you don't. So there's a sense in which too, as Christians, and we don't have the exact same situation where we have Jeremiah, but there's still this. I think it's important for us to realize that you can't really base a lot of your beliefs about what God is or isn't doing by what you see, you know. Because here's the situation where,
yeah,
it's looking really dark, and like God's bailed, or He doesn't care. He's either not present, or He is present. He doesn't care. And they're, you know, I know they're rationalizing their behavior, but it's also contributed. It's a belief that's contributing to them going AWOL even further. You know, it's like sometimes when you're a Christian.
Yeah.
You're in the midst of some situation, you think, I'm the only one, right?
Yeah.
I'm the only one that's offended by this, or I'm the only one that's trying to do the right thing here, and everyone else has gone AWOL, right? it's similar sort of thing. And so, to me, you know, when I read this, one of the things I see in it is that you just can't judge by what you see, and if there are people in the midst of the church that purport to be knowing what God's doing and they're wrong,
yeah,
then there's damage that comes from that.
I think it's man's tendency to hear and see the things they want to hear and see, rather than if it's bad news, they kind of could easily go in the other direction, you know. It's like keeping up people that want to hear, with itchy ears, want to hear, you know, get pastors who want to tell them what they want to hear, you know, that type of thing. And so these people probably, they didn't want to, you know, go off into captivity, and so they had people telling them, hey, you don't have to worry about that, you know. Mm-hmm. So that would be an easy tendency to fall into.
I've made this point before, I think, quite a few times here at church, and just, you know, like I said before, one of my favorite books was Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, and there's a part in there that always really stood out to me, and it's in the context of the main character being in the middle of World War II in England, and, you know, it was just horrible at the time. They were getting blitzed and all that stuff, you know, and What Screwtape says is that...
And he's a demon, right?
And Screwtape is a demon, so we were looking at this from the opposite point of view. The kind of person, the kind of Christian, that, or, you know, believer or whatever, that the demons don't want, and conversely, than God wants, is the kind of person who can look around in the world and see, like, all evidence of God disappear and still believe. You know, it points to the fact that victory is always in faithfulness, no matter what your circumstances may be. And like, you know, that part of the book has always stood out to me as being maybe the one of the most important lessons in there. Because, yeah, I mean, what for the true believer, there isn't really a choice for a true believer. No matter what happens, you're always called to be faithful, to keep believing in God and keep following Him. And that's, you know, I'm not saying that's easy. That's not easy when things are good, you know. So never mind when it's all, you know, going to pot. But, you know, I'm always reading through this part of the Bible, you know, that middle section where all the prophets, they keep prophesying judgment, and then I, you know, I always think about that, you know, from the Screwtape Letters. It's like you said, it's a little bit disappointing and disheartening that so often that's not the case, that they're not what happens when it should be, but, you know.
Because you don't always know what God's doing.
Yeah.
Because He can be, you know, working and waiting through that, or really for something good.
Yeah, I mean, like.
And you're going, okay, well, it looks really bad. you know, them or whatever. They're not getting it, and then later on, if that doesn't happen.
So you have a choice. You have a choice to do like the Israelites did, you know, and think, well, God left me, so I'm on my own. I got to do something, you know, so I will worship this idol or something.
Yeah, well, there's your trust, right?
Yeah.
Put you in those situations, you're
all. And I think it's interesting, too, is if, and I think there's an intentional, when you study the book of Daniel, there's an intentional foil, if you will, between down in Jerusalem, the priests, the temple, there's still a bunch of people, there's still a king, and how are they acting? You got Daniel, young kid. These are all elders, right? Daniel, a young kid, hauled off to this pagan place. He's being taught all this pagan stuff. He's, as far as he knows, he's never going to see, you know, maybe. He knows, actually, he learns about Jeremiah's prophecy, so he knows it's for a period of time. But you know, when he's young and he's taken off there, he's completely removed from his family, from his heritage, from everything. He's put in a complete pagan training program. And look at how he behaves there. You know, he's faithful to God. He still believes God is, he and his friends, right?
Right.
The fiery furnace. So there's this point in which this is one of those cases where it's helpful to know the two books are about the same time period and about the same historical situations, and God is purposely saying, you know, here's Nebuchadnezzar setting up a huge, impressive symbol and saying, bow down before it or you're going to die, and they won't. And over here, people are setting up their own idols in the temple and bowing down to them, and nobody's forcing them to do it, right?
Well, and like, or not to go off too much into that, into a bunny trail, but again, so this, back to the Screwtape letters, I don't have to ruin the ending for people who maybe haven't read it, but at the end, the main character dies in the war, but he stayed faithful throughout the whole thing. And Screwtape is furious, you know, at the demon who was supposed to be, you know, tempting him the whole time, because in the end, he, even though he died, still a young man, which the world would count as a, you know, as tragedy and loss, and he's victorious because he's saved, he's got salvation. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they're going in the furnace, they're like, our God is able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we're still not going to worship your idol. I mean, you know, victory for a true believer is something different than what it is for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And that's where faith is just this huge thing. Because if you don't have faith, there's no way that you can walk those. The priorities just are such that you can't do that.
Yeah.
And, and that's the thing. I mean, even when it talks about where is your sting, O death, right? Escaping. I mean, a big part of what he talks about in that passage is that to escape the fear of death.
Yeah.
And you can't escape the fear of death unless you truly believe you have eternal life and it's just a transition, you know? And so, you know, faith just operates on so many levels, you know, and The more you think about it and look about the different things, or you read some of these books like Fox's Books of Martyrs, or the one the Newsboys worked on, Jesus Freaks, we've got three or four of the different books that people have put out, studies of martyrs at different periods of time. When you read through those books, you see that same situation. Want me to get some water? Are you
no,
okay? You sure?
Talking too much.
Okay. No, you never talk too much. But you know, you just I mean, that's the thing that you see when you read, you know, and again, the Screwtape letters or church history, it's not the Bible, but it still strengthens your faith because you get to see how there's other people besides us who are called of God in different historical settings. And they did some amazing, amazing things. And you look at it and you go, wow. You know? And it builds your faith to read those situations. Especially when you have situations like, you know, some young girl is in some sort of an inquisition by these, you know, theologians of the opposite viewpoint that are trying to get her to accept some weird view and just hold straight, you know, like Catholic guys trying to get her to deny a Protestant faith or whatever, and you and the conversations that are recorded and stuff, they're just like, just amazing. So I read the Screwtape Letters quite a while ago and I really enjoyed it. It's by C.S. Lewis. And like he says, it's about this kind of head demon and his advice to these sub-demons about what to do with various Christian people they're working on. So, you know, that it is interesting, just as an aside, some of these works, these traditional or kind of classic works like C.S. Lewis, like Screwtape Letters, I don't know if you'd call it a classic, but it's near classic. But certainly Pilgrim's Progress would fall in, be considered a classic. My own experience with them has been, you know, the first time I looked at them or got into them, I thought, what is this? What world does everybody make such a big deal about this? This is kind of goofy. And I couldn't even get into it. And then later I came back to it and got into it, and I'm like, what was wrong with me before? This is pure genius. You know? You know, you start to realize it's kind of like reading the Bible almost. You know how you read things and you don't see things, and then you come back to it later and you see, wow, that's really rich. I never picked up on that. Some Christian authors are like that too. Some of the stuff they put together, I mean, they, you know, like John Bunyan or whatever, he spent a lot of time in jail, and sitting in jail, you get to think a lot about the Christian faith and all different aspects of it.
That's Paul. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
good point.
You know, and they have a lot of insights, and it's pretty neat stuff. So it mentions here in verse 11 these 70 men of the elders, and again the fact that it keeps talking about, you know, these elders and stuff. It's, you can read elder. You can replace it with the phrase, people who are supposed to know better. Because that's, you know, versus Daniel, a young kid who shouldn't know better, right? So these are guys who are supposed to know better. And it mentions this Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan. So I went off and looked up a little bit on that. And it's kind of interesting that he's mentioned there. And because it turns out that this guy Shaphan had a bunch of sons, and the guy himself was responsible for, he's the one that found the book of the law in Josiah's time. You remember Josiah was the last called the king, and they were like sweeping out the temple, which had been full of idols and all this stuff. They're cleaning the temple and they're like, oh, what's this old dusty scroll? Right. I mean, they had completely they completely lost track of the Bible, if you will. Right? It'd be like 300 years from now, the United States, nobody even knows there's a Bible or anything about Jesus, and some guy's doing archaeological dig and he comes up with, hopefully not the Book of Mormon. That must be Moroni right now calling you. But they dig up some Bible, you know, and they read it and they find out.
Was that you?
Yeah, it was me.
Sorry. I didn't put it on.
Yeah, I didn't put it on.
Yeah, sure did. Yeah. I was good, about to go back.
I know, I was too. I was going, well, he's jumping up, sort of.
Ventriloquist phone. Yeah.
Wow.
You keep saying you want to change your ringer.
But when you think about that, I mean, here's Israel, right? And, you know, they had the Ten Commandments and the writings of Moses way before they ever had a temple or anything like that, right? And so the giving of the law and the Levitical laws and all that stuff, you know, God says he's elevated the word above his own name. So the temple is not as important as the words that he gave, really. So there they are. They've completely lost track of the book of the law. I mean, it's hard to even believe, right? It'd be like the United States forgetting there was a Constitution. I mean, it's just like, what? I mean, it's one thing to know there's a constitution and screw around with it, but it's another thing to lose track of the fact that you even have one.
Yeah, that is
right.
Wow.
And so this guy Shaphan was in 2 Kings 22, was the one who found the book of the law, and he had a bunch of different sons. And if you look at these different sons, one of them, Josiah sent. He was sent by Josiah to Huldah the prophetess to verify that this scroll was legit. And that son also protected Jeremiah from being condemned to death. That was in Jeremiah 26. Another of the brothers, or one of the sons, he urged Jehoiakim not to destroy Jeremiah's scroll. Remember, Jeremiah wrote the scroll, and I think it was Baruch took it to the king, and the king throws it in the fire.
Yeah, it had to be written all over.
Yeah, so he had to write it again. Another of the brothers took Jeremiah's letter to the exiles in Babylon. So you've got basically four of these brothers. Three out of the four were involved in very significant godly things. They're recorded in the Bible. I mean, that's pretty significant, right? To get your name in the Bible and you did something right. I mean, how many people are in there, right? And then the father, obviously. And then here's this one brother. And so when God singles him out here, you know, he's singling him out, he's saying, you know, can you believe it? Can you believe it, Ezekiel? You remember Shaphan? You remember the other brothers? What happened to this guy? Of all the people who should be there, who shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And that just gets back to the same sort of thing that you struggle with all the way through the Christian walk. It's just seeing the hand of God is just, it's, you know, the interplay between God's sovereignty and man's responsibility, and the whole issue that you can't guarantee anything. You mean this father, you know, I doubt he raised that one son all completely differently than the other son, right? And yet, look what you get. And I think this comes into play for parents too. Try as you might, do what you will, you know. And the other thing too, which is, if you did mess it up, that doesn't mean that they won't come around, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it works both ways. On the side where maybe you didn't do so well, God's sovereignty and his response to prayer is still operational. And on the other side, if you did an outstanding job and they go AWOL, you can't really own that at some point. You just really can't own it.
And we do have one assurance. So
what's that?
If we bring them up in the way of the Lord, they will return.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how that goes?
Yeah, there's different ideas about that. But if you, I'd have to go to the actual passage.
Depends on whether you take an optimistic view or a pessimistic
view.
Train up a child in the way that he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Right.
Is that how it goes?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it meant even if he does depart from it, he will return to it.
I don't know.
I think there's two. There's a number of different views there. One is that that's what it means.
Yeah.
You know, another one is that it's part of, it's Proverbs, right?
Proverbs.
Yeah, and so the Proverbs are stating general principles that don't hold in every case. So it's not a guarantee, but it's a general tendency. And then the third one is that training them up in the way they should go has to do with recognizing how God has gifted them and made them.
Yeah. But that's Ephesians or something like that.
Yeah. I tend toward the idea that it is talking about godliness and that it's a principle, but it's not like a money back guarantee. You know, just like many of the Proverbs.
But it doesn't hurt to do it anyway.
No, you definitely. It's
fact,
like,
I better be doing
it.
That's
a principle.
Yeah.
Do it.
Right. It's necessary but not sufficient, as the mathematicians would say. So So here's this guy, Jazaniah, the son of Shaphan, who had this godly father and godly family, and he's in there with the censer whooping it up. And, you know, completely, he's one of the elders that out there, and it's like significant enough that it gets God's attention to actually list this guy's name.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of scary in a way, huh? See what they do in the dark. As soon as you got dark, you got trouble. Right? Yeah,
pretty much.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I think most people here had some exposure to masonry and read some of the background from a Christian perspective, but, you know, the very fact that you'd have some place that everyone, or the Mormon temple or whatever, any kind of place that it's all boarded up, the windows are all shut, and people go in there and you don't have a clue what's going on,
yeah.
Just don't go there.
Yeah.
It's just bad.
Yeah, there's trouble and brewing.
You know, and that's like some churches now, I guess. And some churches, they're painting their windows and stuff because they want to have a certain mood and stuff inside. But to me, it's like, if you got to pull the blinds and paint your windows, man, I wouldn't be going there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a kind of an aside, but... So what about this Tammuz? Has anyone read much about that or heard anything about it?
So here's an...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just popped in my head that the Bud Hut on the island,
mm-hmm.
No, there's two windows,
yeah.
And they always have their shades drawn.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
that same
yeah,
concept.
I hate to say going to pot.
You know, it's the same thing. It's just,
I know, it
yeah,
is, but I thought, boy, now it's literal. That was
well,
around 60.
You know, funny thing here, our
adult entertainment.
Talking about things like that, like,
mm-hmm.
It wouldn't, it almost, I mean, it's bad. It'll always be bad. But it wouldn't be so bad if they didn't try and sell it in a brighter light. You know, there's all these health benefits to marijuana or whatever. Just,
mm-hmm.
No, you want to smoke pot because you want to smoke pot. You want to get high. That's the reason. Even medicinal, people who use it for medicinal purposes,
mm-hmm.
That's the reason they're using it. It's
mm-hmm.
not to cure anything or whatever. If,
yeah,
I would have much less problem with it if they would just admit
honest,
that.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah, it's
but.
Like a liar's professor at the seminary talking about what inerrancy is, and he's like, completely being double-handed about
yeah.
what it really is.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what makes you mad. At least to be honest about
yeah.
what you think, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Tammuz, there's these women who are sitting there weeping for Tammuz.
I can't think of it right now.
Yeah.
Fertility God?
Yeah. So it's the Hebrew form of a Sumerian god called Dumuzi.
The son of the supposed son that was, when you see an icon, quite often they'll show an older person as a baby.
Right.
He's supposed to be, isn't he supposed to be from a virgin birth?
Well, there's lots of, yeah, so there's lots of different versions of a similar idea, and I'm not an expert on pagan gods, so I don't really know how to sort them all out, but there is this idea, there is a connection with the idea of rising from the dead, where this, so basically this deity had to do with spring vegetation, right? So in spring, Tammuz would rise again in the spring and bring life-giving rain. And then in the hot summer, when the vegetation died, the idea was that Tammuz descended into the underworld. And then people would grieve that he was gone, and then next spring he would rise again, bringing life. But then there were a bunch of fertility rites associated with this too, kind of like the Parthenon, you know, situations where they had women involved. And so, like, you'll see passages in the scriptures that talk about things going on the high places. It wasn't just pagan worship, it was also sexual rites associated with some of these fertility religions. So I don't know all, thank goodness, I don't know much about it, but Mama told me not to come. So, but it's, again, it's a fertility rite, kind of a goddess, a god worship, that's a fertility rite, and that the women were involved with, that of course was abhorrent to God.
So this must have been later in the year when this was happening.
Yeah, potentially, because if I read about Tammuz, about them weeping for Tammuz, would indicate that
we're in the off season.
They're in the off season. Yeah, yeah. I mean, some guys do this about football when it's not football season, but I'm not sure how similar that is. Kevin could tell us.
Yeah, for the Tammuz warriors or something.
So he keeps saying, you know, turn again, you'll see greater abominations. And so now, notice as he's talking about greater abominations in verse 16, he's going now into the inner court. So as he goes further in, it's of course more holy area. And so now he's between the porch and the altar, and it's interesting that same phrase appears in other places. In connection with the idea, like in Joel, it talks about let the priests who minister to the Lord weep between the porch and the altar, saying, spare your people, O Lord. So the idea is that that's an area where really only priests are supposed to be, and they're supposed to be interceding when God's judgment is involved or when things aren't going right. The idea is that the priests are going to intercede there. You know, weep between the porch and the altar. Spare your people, Lord. Do not give your heritage to the reproach that the nations should rule over them. And why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? So the picture of what's going on in that location with priests in Joel is all about intercession. That when there is situation that looks like God's judgment, or when it does look like there's things where another nation is coming to take them, then the priests are supposed to be interceding in prayer as spiritual leaders. And of course here he gets into the same area, and a number of commentators think that these 25 men are supposed to be priests, or they're guys that would be in a priestly role, but instead of interceding, so if they were really interceding between the porch and the altar, and I think the altar they're talking about is the altar prayer, which is before the Holy of Holies. It's not, it's in the inner court, but it's not in the holy place. So you would be facing, typically you would be facing toward the Holy of Holies to the west, with your back to the east, right? Because that's how you come into the temple. So they should have their backs to the east. They should be facing west, and the Holy of Holies should be on the other side of the veil. And if you're addressing God in the temple, that's the direction you would.
Yeah, so we're
180. So they're like ignoring the Holy of Holies. They got their backsides to the Holy of Holies, and they're worshiping the sun toward the east. Yikes. So you've got astronomical worship, which is a thing that God brings up all through Scripture. Don't worship the Son of the Moon. Look, they're just a couple of things I created up there. You know. But even today, you've got people heading in this direction. You always have people heading in this direction. So there's this whole business about, you know, you can make the argument, if you look at how Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden, they're kicked out toward the east, And so when you do a bigger, you just look at all the different things about temples. One of the things you see is that the temples and the whole situation is arranged in such a way that you come in from the east and you look to the west. And there's a number of people that have commented that they believe that was partly by design, that God did that to differentiate this worship from the common worship of facing to the rising sun, right? So he set up the world, he set up the sun and the earth and the orbits and all that, and the sun rises in the east, and he knew, you know, people who are going to tend to in the morning, they're going to look to the east, and people who don't have knowledge of God overall, if they're going to be drawn into worship of the sun, they're probably going to be facing east. Like if they put up a Stonehenge or do this or another, east is going to be one of the key things that's involved. So in a sense, when you come into the temple to worship God in the Holy of Holies, you turn your back on the sun. You know, and there's nothing explicit about it, but there's this implicit idea that you're ignoring the astronomical key direction because you have the truth about God and he's not the heavenly body that you should worship. And it's, you can't make too much about it, but here the fact that they're turned around the other way kind of supports that idea too.
We're living on the wrong side of the island.
Yeah, right. You don't want to have a view out that way. Look out.
And they don't ever say anything in the Bible about west. I mean, we should be toward the west, not the east.
Often, yeah,
as
it
a
is.
Negative
consequence. Yeah, because of the sun.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not like worshiping the sunset. It's
yeah.
The sunrise.
Well, in fact, the term
like
for
what,
east.
New life, new day, new what?
So the term east means the place of rising.
Okay.
So the idea of east is connected with sunrise, right? Mm-hmm. And newness of life, right?
That's
the dark of the
day. Instead of, you know, it's getting dark.
Right.
You know, want that, right? You know,
right. Right.
We'll do it, but, you know. Yeah. Anyway, just something.
So they're looking to the east, worshiping the sun, and ignoring the Holy of Holies. You know, and you contrast that with the Day of Atonement, for example, where Yom Kippur or whatever, when the high priest would go in to the Holy of Holies, he may have to do all this preparation and go in through the veil. Scary.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to burn incense when he was in there, and the incense, the function of the incense was to separate him from God, the presence of God,
mm-hmm.
so that he wasn't completely unshielded. It was the idea of, you know, it wasn't just a sweet aroma from God, but I don't have my notes right here too, but there's the idea that God says, you know, he needs to burn incense lest he die,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's part of this idea is just like the glory of God is fire and cloud, you know, it's enclosed in cloud because if it wasn't shielded, you know, it's kind of interesting, but they have these this is a rabbit, but I won't spend much time on it, but when they're working on fusion, right? They've got different kinds of fusion reactors they're working at. And if you read some of the articles on the internet about, I think it's called a tokamak, I'm trying to think if I have the term right, but these reactors, they're fusion reactors they're working on. They're like the most complex things man has ever devised. I mean, they make the moonshot look like, well, I wouldn't say kid stuff, but they're equivalent to the moonshot kind of thing. And so the level of engineering and everything they have to do in these complex curves where they send these high-energy plasma around in certain shapes and everything. Anyway, if you read that article as a Christian, you can't read that article without thinking about the Shekinah glory of God, because they have this huge magnetic fields that they use to generate in this very complex, kind of almost like a Mobius strip kind of thing, that this high-energy plasma stays contained, because if you can't keep it contained, it's going to blow the whole apparatus apart, right? Because you have the slightest leak of that stuff, it's like super high-energy, and it'll just vaporize and melt everything, right? So you've got this really, 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 really powerful force, and you're containing it. So that's this whole business of this fusion reactor, and it gives you a picture, I think, of some of these things where the glory of God in the clouds and stuff, where you know the power more powerful than the universe, the one that called the universe into existence, is sitting there in some form, and he's got it shielded, right? Just like when he puts Moses in the rock, he says, "I'm not going to show you my face," yeah. You know. It's way more than this fusion reactor they're going to come up with in a few thousand years. And, you know, so the whole idea of this business of his glory residing in a certain place and him willfully restraining his glory, in a sense, because if he didn't restrain it, I mean, the whole earth would be vaporized, right? I don't know what would happen, right? So I think when you see God even... when you see this idea that God's going to put his presence somewhere, there's this huge restraint involved, right? Because he's, even for him to bring a representation of his glory anywhere near man and then shield man from it, you know, we look at Jesus in these robes, right, being mocked and spit on, and people slap him and they say, you know, who hit you, you know, and you're the king of the Jews and stuff, and we're thinking, that's God, you know. And you see that and you think, what restraint,
yeah.
What power that nothing happened there, right? And so you see these situations too where God comes in the midst of people and they don't do the right things, and you think, wow, you know, what restraint that they're sitting there close to the Holy of Holies, mm-hmm. They've got their backs to God. It's not like they're out here on Camino Island at the time. You know, they're right there in the mm-hmm. temple. They had their backs to God, and they're worshiping the sun, and
yeah.
then just like right
yeah.
behind them is the Holy of Holies.
Yeah, I think that's too about this, you know, incense and how people in immersion church or whatever, even when I was at TLU, they were, you know, during their service, they'd have incense. And I was kind of like, well, what's that about, you know? And when you think about them using it, they're not even necessarily... No, it's just, it's in the Bible, and they don't think of what it means in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It just smells good.
It just smells good, it's atmosphere. you know, I think it's interesting that you have things like that, that are just pulled in.
Right.
And there's nothing aside from the word has it in there. They have no idea how it was used or what it signifies or... God versus man's point of view with it, and yeah.
Well, I think it's a good indication too that the people that are involved with it don't have a contextual understanding of the Bible, because they're jumping back into the Old Testament, grabbing things from the house of God in Israel and taking bits and pieces of it and using it in the church. It's kind of weird.
Well, this is kind of one of the reasons I've always had a problem with the whole, like, modern church's view on God is love and all that stuff. I mean, I understand the concept, and I'm not saying that it isn't true and it isn't right and it isn't good,
right?
But at the same time, what, you know, you're talking about God here, like you're saying, this awesome force, you know, like what you're saying is basically... these guys are in their, you know, tank top and shorts standing in a nuclear reactor, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing. You know, they're not showing the proper respect for this enormous force that's right next to them. And, you know, I understand that, yes, we do need to see God as, you know, the loving God that he is, because, like you said, If he didn't restrain himself, we'd all be vaporized or whatever. And, you know, God shows his love for us and that he hasn't vaporized us for all that we've done, you know. There's a psalm that says he must humble himself to behold things in heaven and earth. He's that great. He has to humble himself to notice all of this, which he created in the first place. And, like, you know, there's just that. But when, like, you know, I get... that there's a lack of love in the world, and a lot of people need to cling to that. But there's this in it, I feel like, oftentimes, and it's kind of one reason that I've always had a problem with it, is that there's this kind of lack of respect or proper proper respect, proper awe, you know.
Well, fear of the Lord.
Yeah. That this is God we're talking about. I mean, there's no way to define it, really, you know, because He is that much, that far above us. We just can't even put words to it. But, like, there should be maybe a little bit more. Yeah, balance is probably a good word for it, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's
I mean, love is probably the most important word description that comes out in the Bible. But also, I hear a lot of people, a lot of pastors even, when you bring up the thing about fear of the Lord, you know, I don't know, was it fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom or something like that. Anyway, they say, well, that doesn't really mean to be scared of the Lord, scared of Him, you know. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, this, you know, if He took His thought away from you for a second, we'd all disappear, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something to be fearful about. The point of love is, I think, one of the most important aspects of what we, of our relationship with God. I mean, the fear comes in there when the more we know Him, the more we understand what, you know, about Him and everything. But I think we're supposed to learn to love Him.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do that, because I have a hard time with that, you know, that particular aspect of it. I think I could fear Him more than love Him, you know, but I think somehow it's kind of mixed together.
Well,
it's
like,
all in a big,
like Debbie was saying, it just probably needs to be more balanced. Because, like, a lot, what I see a lot is that people get so caught up in the whole love thing for God, they start treating Him a little bit frivolously, you know.
Yeah,
I think He's their buddy.
Yeah.
Or they refer to Him like they would a buddy. You know, rather than God of the universe, Savior of all mankind and all that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Creator of all mankind.
Well, it's kind of like they've shrunk their view of God into their human mindset of Him, you know? Another human.
That's really my only problem with it, because, we do need to understand how much God loves us, because it is very important.
See, I think what you're talking about is the whole issue of balancing the attributes of God, you know, in that error has always got some truth in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to really be accurate, and as accurate as we can be in our understanding of God, then we need to kind of keep all His attributes evenly represented in our mind. And so when we focus on one more than another, and usually we can't focus on them all, so it's like we look at this, you know, we're going around forever looking at the different, but like, I do think that when the balance is lost, it does lead to some things that are unfortunate, you know. And I think, Kevin, you and I have talked about this, you know, just in the business of worship music, you know, God does love the world, and He did give His only Son, but when people put so much focus on love and not on the judgment and the fear part and the perfection and all the other holiness part of it, you end up putting more focus on yourself, even if you don't intend to, because you're like, well, it's all about what God did for me. And there's a sense in which that's true. What God did for you is just amazing. But that's not really the big picture of the Bible. The big picture of the Bible isn't what God did for me. It's what is God doing in history, who is He, and what's His glory about. That's the big picture. And part of that is redemption, which is a huge part of it. But just getting that a little out of picture, I think you could take a lot of the worship music that's come out in the last 50 years and compare it with previous generations. Looking at the lyrics, and you can see that there's much more focus on, I'm damaged, He repaired me, He loves me, and a lot less on, look at who He is, and isn't He glorious, right? And I'm not saying that second message is wrong or bad, but it's when, like, all the music kind of is that way, and there's none of the other anymore.
No balance.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, that's self-centered. When you're thinking that.
Yeah, it ends up saying, well, God did this wonderful thing for me,
yeah.
And therefore I'm really important. I'm important to God, and that is true. You're important to God, and you can see part of it has to do with it's a cultural reaction to the fact that people don't have meaning and purpose and value, and they've been mistreated and abused and had all sorts of relational problems. Mm-hmm. So we are damaged goods, right? And we do need repair, right? And that's awesome that God does that. But I think it is important to have the full orb, because I think that's one of the things that strikes me when we pull out our hymnals, you know, because we always have a couple of songs that are from the hymnals and a couple of more modern ones, and there's some awesome, really awesome modern songs. We did several last Sunday that are just really awesome. But when you pull out the hymnals, you know, you can be singing a song that you're just not all that excited about, the tune,
yeah.
But you look at the lyrics,
yeah.
And it's like, whoa, you know? They're amazing lyrics. And I think some of the people that wrote those songs are coming from a different age where where different aspects of God were more in the fore for the songwriters.
Mm.
It just seems all over. So
the rooster is gone.
Yeah. Without the rooster, we don't know what to do.